This episode of Beyond the Uniform is sponsored by Warfighter Hemp, whose mission is to provide our nation's veterans with organic, non-addictive, non-psychoactive means to manage pain, lower anxiety, and improve the overall quality of their lives. 50% of Warfighter Hemp's profits go back to veterans. In episode number 218, I spoke with Warfighter Hemp's founder, Steve, and since then, I've been a fan of both their company and their products. Warfighter Hemp is offering Beyond the Uniform listeners 20% off their first purchase using the promo code BTU20 at checkout. That's BTU20. Thanks and enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help military veterans and their families succeed in their civilian career. Today's episode number 306, with Vietnam Wounded in Action and four-time NFL Super Bowl champion Rocky Blyer.
They probed our perimeter, got close enough when a grenade comes flying through the air, and I see it, catch it out of the corner of my eye, hits my commanding officer, and it just in slow motion bounces off of his back and starts to roll to where I am, and I'm but 4 feet from him. And so I get up to jump out of the way, and it blows up, and I was standing on top of it. So the doctor's biggest response, correct or not, in his diagnosis of that situation, you know, was, no, you'll never, not with the injury to your foot specifically, be able to, from his perspective, run or play or push off or do the things that you need to do to be a running back in the NFL. That's what he said.
Well, if you're a longtime Beyond the Uniform listener, you may realize that we jumped from episode 297 to 306. That's not a mistake. It's more based on the fact that we had an opportunity, thanks to ESPN, to sit down with Rocky Blyer to talk about his military experience, his NFL experience, and his upcoming show, The Return, which will air on ESPN on August 20th. And so we wanted to jump the queue. We wanted to get this episode out earlier, and that's the reason for the misnumbering there. This is a fantastic interview. There's so much to appreciate about Rocky's experience. The one thing I wanted to call out is that he shares in this interview how he was in the NFL. He was drafted into the Vietnam War. While he's there, he goes through some significant wounding experience and is told he'll never play play football again. And yet, through grace, through dedication, through perseverance and tenacity, he comes back to not just play in the NFL again, but to win 4 Super Bowls. And it is not an easy journey. It's not the hallmark story that you might think it is of just coming back and conquering. He talks about the doubts that he faced, the setbacks he faced, and how he tried to quit, and thankfully, again through grace, was prevented from doing so and went on to an incredible career. I did not have the chance prior to starting the interview to read Rocky's bio like I normally do, so I wanted to give just a very brief bio on Rocky to set the stage before diving into the conversation. So, not falling within the ideal of what a running back should look like, Blyer had to run harder and play smarter to be able to stand out. Despite his drive and ability to make the big play, the Pittsburgh Steelers only considered him in a late round pick. But before the season ended that first year, he was drafted again, this time by the United States Army. At the height of the Vietnam War, Rocky was thrust into combat early and was seriously wounded when his platoon ran into an ambush. Receiving wounds from both rifle fire and grenade fragments in his leg, he was barely able to walk, and his professional football career seemed to have ended before it began. For more than 2 years, Rocky drove himself little by little. He overcame obstacles and fought his way back. He not only made the Pittsburgh Steelers, but also eventually became a starting running back on a team that won 4 Super Bowls and became the greatest football team of the 20th century. The hard lessons Rocky learned early in his life that helped him overcome adversity and reach his goals have paid off after football. These lessons are seen between the lines in the popular book on his life, Fighting Back, and on stages of speaking appearances around the country. thank you again to ESPN for connecting us prior to the airing of his show, The Return. And with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Rocky. Well, joining me today in Pittsburgh, my guest I'm honored to have on the show is Robert Patrick Rocky Blyer. Rocky, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you.
So to start things off, I'd love to go back to at the end of your rookie season in the NFL. You received notification that you were going to be drafted. And I'm just wondering, what was your reaction and how did that land for you at the end of what was a dream for you your whole life to be in the NFL, to realize you were going off to war?
You know, so let's go back to that period of time. And for those of us who were involved with the Vietnam War and or the draft at that time that was taking place, it was something that was always on the back of your mind, meaning that once you get out of school, you had that student deferment and that you then became eligible for the draft. You got your 1A classification. That 1A classification for me came during rookie training camp that year in 1968. It was right towards the end of camp. The veterans had been in camp when Bill Austin, the head coach, pulled me aside after a meeting, said, "Listen, I got this letter in the mail. We accidentally opened it, and it was my 1A classification." So he said, don't worry. Said, "We think you're good enough to make this team. We'll take care of this for you." And taking care of that meant, well, I'm thinking, get into the National Guard or the Army Reserve, as a lot of players were doing at that time, and that was, and a lot of other people were joining, because that was part of the requirements of fulfilling your obligation to serve our country. And so I went along with my business. Well, time kept going on. I hadn't heard anything. They hadn't done anything. That was 1968, height of the war. We had the most people over there. Places in the Reserve and National Guard were filled. The general retired, congressman got defeated, whatever excuse they came up with, and all of a sudden, so it became more and more on my mind that this might be a possibility as we're trying to weave our way through that whole process. And then I got my draft notification in November at the time. And so it kind of caught me off guard. Actually, it didn't. Kind of knew it was there, didn't know when. Hopefully we're trying to get into a reserve unit, so on and so on. I fell through the cracks, as they say, and I got drafted. Mm. So it was like, oh man, I opened it. It was to report the next morning. I got it on a Wednesday, and a report the next morning at 7 a.m. at the AFI station in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, be inducted into the armed services of your country. I'm going, oh, man. So I quickly went to the front office of the Steeler organization. What are we going to say? We showed up the next morning. The best they could give me was a 24-hour extension, so I could get my personal things together. And actually, one of the things was that, it was dated, hopefully like a week. You know, I mean, you're supposed to have a week to get this stuff together, get your name in before you had to go through your physical to be inducted. And so it was postmarked a week before. I got it the day before. I'm going, oh man, how did this get screwed up? Anyway, so that was it. But, you know, I guess my feeling as I think about it at that time is you just react to the situation at the time, what took place. You know, I mean, there was thousands of young men that went through that whole process as well. It caught me a little off guard, but, you know, ultimately it was fulfilling that need obligation. So I went back, you know, got sworn in. You know, brought my travel clothes with me, and I was on a bus that afternoon to go to the airport and fly down to where I was going, basic training, and you're in the process of the whole military experience, you know, at that time. So you didn't have a chance to think or whine or cry. You just reacted to the situation, to the drill sergeants, to the commands and demands. And in some regards, and I'm going to say that, some regards, all the training that you'd gone through or I'd gone through, specifically playing sports and football, is that you've kind of been there before. Mm. So every training camp was the same, like basic training, you know. So you're a rookie at some time and some point in your life, as you are a rookie or a non-existent first-time military guy. And so so you just get yelled at, you got to go through the process, you do this, and you're kind of numb, and you just react to it. So as I said, part of it was that you were conditioned to it, and so it was just a continuation, you know, of that experience.
Mm. And what do you remember from the engagement in which you were wounded?
Oh, I remember a lot about that engagement in which I was wounded. Now, just to put that story in the context, is that we, Charlie Company, 4th of the 31st, were sitting on LZ Siberia at this time. Now, in Vietnam, especially in Hep Duc, that area in which we were operated, we operated two companies. Were on LZ's landing zones, and two companies were in the field, and you would rotate up to a landing zone, down into the field, up into a landing zone, down in the field. The landing zones were helicopters came in, but that's where all the artillery was to support that area that we operated in. Sister company had been hit. We were to fly off, get them out of this hot spot. By the time we got there, it was late at night. So on our way out, getting them out of there, carrying what dead was left behind, or bodies, and we are moving. It's about 8:10. It was about 10 o'clock at night. It was dark. We ran into a quick firefight, and the word was to leave the bodies. We'll come back and get them later. So about 2 days later, that was our mission as a reinforced platoon, to come back and find those bodies. And so we had just taken a break about 8 o'clock in the morning when our commanding officer found our location where we were, said, okay, move on out into this open rice paddy. I was eighth in line, just to put in perspective, about 5 yards distance between one another. I was carrying a grenade launcher. And when I stepped out onto that rice paddy, my point man, who's now maybe 40 yards in front of me, we took several steps out of the rice paddy when all of a sudden, I think he made a fatal mistake. He saw movement across the berm. In his excitement, fired at the moving enemy, hollered gook gook, shots broke the stillness. They started to run. We started to chase them, or he did, pulling everybody out in the middle of that rice paddy when all of a sudden, I could hear a machine gun started to level the area, and so guys were diving left and right into rice paddies to try to get out of some harm's way and into some protection. I did crawl on my hands and knees, found another rice paddy below us. I saw four guys who were pinned down. Now, my responsibility was to get firepower on that machine gun nest. I was a grenadier. And so that was within my range. I rolled over my side, breached my first grenade when I got hit the first time, and discharged that grenade, crawled out of that rice paddy into a little more secured area so I could get some more firepower on that position. Eventually the four guys were pinned down. They got out of there. So we were in a firefight there, and eventually medic came over and we crawled back to our commanding officer. About 20 minutes later, the rest of that platoon came crawling in on their hands and knees from that out in the open. We set up another perimeter, didn't know what or who we ran into. They probed our perimeter, got close enough when a grenade comes flying through the air, and I see it, catch it out of the corner of my eye, hits my commanding officer, and it just, in slow motion, bounces off of his back and starts to roll to where I am, and I'm but 4 feet from him. And so I get up to jump out of the way, and it blows up, and I was standing on top of it, and blew up through my right foot, knee, and thigh. Mm-hmm. And so another firefight, eventually a sister platoon fought its way down, dragged us out of there, got to a secured area. But anyway, so that's my remembrance of that action of what took place at that moment in time.
I'm just putting it in context that, you know, you fulfill a lifelong dream. You're playing with the Steelers. You have 24, 48 hours. You're now in the Army, and then you're in Vietnam, and then this crazy situation occurs. And then the thing that's most jarring for me amidst this is to think of the next scene in my head when you're staring at the doctor and he's telling you you'll never play football again. I'm just curious, like what happens in you in that moment, and how is it that you go from lying in that hospital bed to being back in the NFL? Like this recovery that people told you was impossible.
You know, I think part of it is, you know, is the learned experiences that we have that I was talking about. It was like going to boot camp. It was like going to training camp. You know, you've been there before. And you've been yelled at, and you've been told to do this, and you've gone through low crawl. You've done all that kind of stuff, maybe at a different level. So in this situation was that my concern was that I wanted to go back and play football. Okay. I mean, I viewed, you know, it was an injury. There's two kind of learned things here. One of the learned things was that playing sports, being a kid, we get injuries. You know, whether you're playing sports, not playing sports, you're playing in the backyard, you're on a swing, you fall off, you're on a teeter-totter, somebody jumps off and throws you off, you know, or you fell off of a swing and, you know, and you break a bone, break a wrist, or stub a finger, you know, you got scrapes and bruises, and, you know, and there's a learned process. And part of that learned process as we grow up is that you get injuries, and they hurt, go to a doctor, they heal, and then you go back and play again. I mean, it didn't stop you playing in the backyard or any of that other stuff, so you continue to do it. So it's kind of a learned process. So in college, you know, or in high school, you get strains, you get tore ligaments, or you get this, and you know, and so it is like it's kind of a learned process when it heals and you go back and play it. It didn't stop you from thereafter. So in this case, it was kind of the same thing. All right, boom, I got hurt. I got shot. Okay. All right. What's the extent of the damage? That's what I wanted to know. So the doctor's biggest response, correct or not, in his diagnosis of that situation, you know, was no, you'll never, not with the injury to your foot specifically, be able to, from his perspective, run or play or push off or do the things that you need to do to be a running back in the NFL. And that's what he said. So my first thought was, well, okay, I didn't lose a foot. I didn't lose an arm. I didn't lose a limb, damaged as it may be, but we've gone through that before. And so you go through rehab and you see where it takes you, and you put the time and the effort and, you know, get back to the gym, all that kind of process that lies in front of you, you know, but it's not like I couldn't run. It just an extent of how well I was going to run. Well, one of the things was, if you didn't have speed to begin with, you didn't lose anything. So that was kind of, you know, that was kind of my mentality. So you just go back and you start. Now, one of the things, and I think this is it, and he did. So as my authority figure, I mean, he did suck some hope out. You know, he did suck some hope out. And there's a couple things that happen, you know, or whatever, to renew that hope. One was I had run into a young soldier when I was first out of the field, when I was in Da Nang. And he was a triple amputee. He lost his left arm below the elbow and both legs. And he'd stop by the bed. I mean, they would take him in a wheelchair as he was going to therapy, and he'd stop by you know, my pet. And I remember this one day, and he said, "Hey, how you doing?" You know, I'm going, "Well, fine." He said, "Oh, that's great, because you look better today than you did yesterday, because yesterday when you got here, you look like death warmed over." He said, "But we got great docs. We're going to get you out of here. Don't you worry. I'll see you back in the real world one of these days." He had this real positive attitude. And so here I was feeling sorry for myself, hurting, coming out of the field and so on. And yet, you know, he had to live with this atrocity for the rest of his life. But his attitude really, you know, was like, wow. And then part of this story as well is that I got a postcard from Art Rooney. And it had two lines on it. It said this: "Rock, team's not doing well. We need you." Wow, somebody need me. No, they didn't need me, but it was somebody cared, you know, and gave you a little hope that there's a window out there, that somebody knows what you're going through. And so ultimately, you know, I had a pretty positive attitude, you know, about that, knowing a lot of work that had to be done, but it wasn't as if it was not a realization or that it could not happen. It just was different. Now you had to put more work in to get yourself back into shape.
And that more work in, I mean, that wasn't easy. Like in my mind's eye, this is like you return home and you're playing it like you used to, but it was years. I think you described it as like years of 6 to 8 hours a day of going from barely being able to walk to being able to compete at this highest level. Could you talk about that recovery once you were back in the States, but also, I think more compelling, the mindset that helped you over the course of years continue day in and day out to get back into this game?
Well, there's a couple things in this regard. So one is a little dream and, you know, and what needs to be done. So when I was still in the service still attached to the hospitals here at Fort Riley, Kansas, before I got discharged. Okay, so I thought, all right, fine. You know, we needed to go through a process. Okay, you needed to start getting, I was going back to training camp in July, you know, of that year, or whenever I could. At this time, I didn't know I was going to get out in time to make training camp. But so you go, okay, fine. You have to start somewhere, so you got to go and start running. And so, you know, we'd get up, or I'd get up at. I had a job in which I had to do within the service, and so I get up at like 5:30. I go out and run, you know, as best as I possibly could. And it wasn't, you know, I'd run, my foot would bother me, I'd run, it'd just go, you'd run a half a mile, then three quarters, and then a mile, and you just start building up and doing this stuff, and you go to work, and then after work, there's nothing else to do, okay? Mm-hmm. So after work, I'd leave, and I'd go to the gym on base. So I'd go to the gym and start lifting like I did before. And then I'd come back home and, you know, try to run some sprints and, have dinner, go to bed, get up at 5:30 next morning, you know, so that became my routine, because there was nothing really else, you know, to do. So it worked, you know, and so you just put the time and effort in. And one of the things that I truly believed is that, you know, your future, or in this case, it's that it, you know, it's not my decision whether I can play football or make the Steelers again. Mm-hmm. It belongs to the decision of a coach and or ownership or of a team. All I can do is do what I can do to put myself in a position to be able to hopefully change whatever perspective that is. And if it's not good enough, then it's not good enough. And so you ask yourself, so you don't have to ask yourself the question later on, did I do everything I possibly could? So, you know, rather than questioning, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that, you just kind of hopefully do as much as you possibly can. So, and in this case, so there's a couple things that become, you know, very blessed because of it. One is ownership, Rooney family, coming back to Pittsburgh. The season I was a rookie was Bill Austin's last season. He only won two games all season, did not have a winning record. Chuck Knoll is now the new head coach in 1969 when I get a 19, he goes 1-13, a worse record than when I was there as a rookie. So I come back in 1970. So it's a team that's building, and so I get back to training camp, and we go through training camp, and it takes its toll. And I think part of whatever reason that after that training camp, the Steelers, for the goodness of their heart, put me on injured reserve. I needed another operation. I had some shrapnel that's working its way out of my wounds. And so they put me on injured reserve. I did have the operation, but I kind of hung around, you know, so I went to meetings and I was there and ended up going kind of back to practice, hanging around, just standing there and so on, being a dummy, and or whatever, but you were there. So I came back the following year. And so I made the injured reserve. No, I got made the taxi squad. I made the developmental squad, as they call it now. And so in 2 year period, they saw a transformation. They saw somebody that worked hard, you know, at their position, having the opportunity because of maybe their guilt or whatever it is, or their opportunity, or wanting to give back because I had served, whatever reason is, but they provided that. And so all you can do is take advantage of that situation. So you continue to work out, you continue to get bigger. And so if you have enough insecurity in you, you know, you're gonna go, well, I'm not the biggest and I'm not the fastest. And so I got to work on this and I got to work on my conditioning and work on my strength. I got to work on my speed. I got to work on all these things that maybe ultimately makes you a better ball player than those with natural talent who doesn't work or don't work as hard at their skill set. So I, you know, I credit the fact that the Rooney family and allowed me to be there for 2 years, and they gave me 2 years to heal, an opportunity to do something with it. And so by 1973, I did. I mean, I had to do something with it and came into training camp, the best shape, condition, strength than I had ever been before. I weighed 218 pounds. I bench pressed 465 pounds. You know, and I squatted 600 pounds, all that hard work, you know, was kind of paying off. As I tell people, I said, you know, I had 18 and a half inch biceps. You know, I knew that because I measured them myself. But, you know, it's like the self-ego that we, I worked on and so on. But you know, that's part of the process, and not because I, you know, was extraordinary in my determination. It's just that there was an opportunity and I enjoyed playing. I wanted to play. It was nothing else that was distracting of my life at that moment in time. I wasn't married. I didn't have a family. And so I could be somewhat selfish and focused on me and where I was going to go. I didn't want to go to, you know, a doctor or be, you know, I just, this is kind of what I wanted. And so an opportunity prevailed, not because of me, but because of ownership or reasons and so on. So and the biggest thing is I was there and they saw the change and they saw the progress and they saw the hard work. And it wasn't like I would be gone for a year or two and then come back, you know, but they saw it while I was on those injured reserve lists and taxi squad teams.
I love that. I mean, I love the resilience. I love this thought of while you're on active duty of doing the best you could, of just going out for that run. And it probably wasn't nearly as fast as you were used to running, or lifting weights wasn't there. But I love the tenacity of coming back. And I love in your story, this mixture of grace of the Rooney family and they're looking after you and their kindness, yeah, and you're not wasting or missing that opportunity. You gave it everything. You showed up. You continued to improve. And I love your attitude in that too, of just realizing that there was a lot out of your control. You couldn't control their decision-making process, but the piece, the small piece that you owned, you were going to do the best that you could in that arena to give it your all. And it seems like that paid off. I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah. And I think I'd like to share is that there were self-doubts along the way. There were, and probably the biggest self-doubt came after the 73 season and I talk about the story. So 68 and then 69 and now 70 and 71 and 72 and 73 season. In the long haul, it doesn't seem like much until you live through it, but 5 years goes by and it seems like an eternity and there's no, really hope at the end. Even at the 73 season, I tell people, I was the leading ground gainer during the exhibition season in 1972 and 1973. And I only carried the ball once in that period of time. So I was playing special teams, And so as you go through the 73 season, and you're not moving, and you're playing special teams, you've done that before and you struggled to, be able to get there. It wasn't like, well, there's a big light at the end of the tunnel, and you start to question your ability and you start to question what's going to happen here. If you come back to training camp the following year, you're going to have to fight again with every free agent and draft choice, that's coming. Starters had already been predetermined. You ever get that? They're already there. Backups are already there. You're looking to try to make that one spot or two mm-hmm. spots that they're going to use on special teams. And I thought, well, maybe, I got 5 years in for my retirement and I got a chance to come back and play. Maybe not to the level I wanted to, but that wasn't part of the deal. It was just kind of like, you got here and maybe my life's going in another direction. I did come back. Okay. I did make the team. I got a chance to play. And so after the 73 season, and I have to tell you this, is that in my mind, I was not going to go back. In my mind, I was not going to go back for the 1974. I'd kind of retired. I was trying to find my life's work, as Chuck Noll would like to say, at that time. And so I was in Chicago selling insurance. And it's amazing, as you look at turning points within your lives and you don't question, it just happened. I get a phone call from Andy Russell. Andy Russell's our all-pro linebacker for us, captain of the football team. He was coming to Chicago. Big sports dinner taking place, sponsored by the NFL. He said, why don't you come and join us? A lot of guys are coming from around the league. It'd be great to get together again and so on. Well, I wasn't going to go back. So I declined and he pushed and I declined some more. And then he asked me the question, why? Oh, why don't you join us? And the only thing he blurted out was I quit. I'm not coming back. And he said to me, he said, you can't quit. If you quit what you've already done, is that you have already made a decision for the coaching staff. Do you like them well enough to make decisions for them? He said, no, if this is what you want to do, is that you come back, you make them make a decision. You give them every reason to keep you or release you, but you don't cut yourself. The reality of this game is that we're all expendable. The reality of this game is that we all can be cut at any time. But if this is what you want, you don't cut yourself. And maybe it was just a little pep talk I needed, the arm twisting I wanted, and maybe like an older brother that I didn't have, so it changed my mind, and I went back. And I think about it often at times, what if I didn't answer the phone? What if I wasn't there when he called? I would have missed that opportunity. But that little speech changed my life and I came back in 1974. And that was the beginning of the rest of my career. And when we get an opportunity to break into the starting lineup in 74 and then win the division, go to the playoffs and win our first Super Bowl, and the story continues.
I love that, because as I was reading about your story, it seemed to me like there's this postcard and this dinner, both of which were the nudges that you needed at those precise points. And I find your story even more encouraging because of them. Like, from an outside perspective, if it was just a I came back from Vietnam and I was going to play for the NFL and then I did. To me, that's less compelling than hearing the doubts that you experienced and the setbacks and the sadness and the grief and all of these like real human emotions that went along with this journey. And even hearing that you were going to quit makes it more accessible to me to realize that, you know, at that moment when you needed it most, your teammate saw that and gave you just the little boost that you needed. And that, what I love about that for listeners is that little nudge got you past, and who would have known this entire world of possibilities that you were able to live through? Like maybe in an alternate version, maybe you missed that phone call and you went off to something else and you would have never known about this greatness that was waiting for you.
You know, and very much so. And when I have an opportunity to talk to individuals, you know, and so on, in the same case, it's like, you know, it's an amazing impact that we have on other individuals mm-hmm. that you may not consider at all, or maybe not even think about it. How you may change their day at that moment because of something you said or something you didn't say. Mm. Or some negative thing that you said that might have changed them one way or the other. Mm. So life is really it's interesting and complicated impact of emotions and thoughts and influences and reasons that you make choices that you do. Hey, and along the way, we make some bad choices and we get some things that we regret, you know, but you know, hopefully we try to make the right choices along the way. And for me specifically, it wouldn't have been, you know, except for those little incidences that took place. And I think it's how you really perceive those incidences. And if you want them to work, you know, some people, you might see them, but it doesn't mean the same thing. And all of a sudden you've lost them and it doesn't change who you mm. are, or you didn't take it into account or whatever it is. And maybe you didn't want to hear what they had to say. And so your life goes in another direction.
Mm. I love that thought too, of putting myself in the shoes of either Art Rooney or of your teammate, of saying like, I could be that voice in someone else's life. Maybe they need that encouragement. Maybe they need that opportunity to think of the impact we can have on others through a kind word, through encouragement, or even challenging you like he did, of like, why won't you join for this dinner? That's great that he was willing to push you and willing to challenge you at a time yeah. where that really served you.
Yeah. And, you know, and really, in all honesty, you go, okay, you know, and now part of it was Andy was that kind of a guy, no matter who and where. I mean, he always stayed in touch with his teammates and he would pick up the phone and he'd make the call. Some of us don't do that, you mm-hmm. know, and for whatever reason, Mr. Rooney sends me a postcard, not out of any one postcard, but you have to put into context is that at his time, at that period of his life, those postcards were his texts mm-hmm. or emails that we have today. How many times, you know, you out with somebody or just had a interview with somebody and then we send them a little text. Hey, thanks, it was great being with you. And or a little email, you know, and so on. Well, that didn't exist back then. He carried those postcards with him. And so he would meet you, have dinner with you or whatever, had a business, whatever it might be. And he would just drop you a line. And so in this course, that was part of who he was. But in this course, that dropping me a line made all the difference in the world.
Mm. And amidst all of this, you know, you go on, you're win four Super Bowls, you're this leading veteran voice on Vietnam, you write a book, which we'll talk about in a second. But I'm just wondering, as you look back on that period, what are you most proud of, or what memory kind of stands out amidst all of these incredible events that transpired?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know whether there's one that really stands out. I mean, if you look at them, I mean, they kind of come in sequence, they happen, mm-hmm. you know, and because of this, you get a chance, you know, to be in a position to have those memories, you know, whether it being the first time we get a chance to start in the backfield. The first time, we in that year you win a division and you go to the Super Bowl and for the first time and you're introduced as a starting running back in the Super Bowl. And so you go, who knew there was going to be 2, 3, or 4 thereafter, or all those other memories. So it makes it's hard to pick out, which one because of this and because of that, it leads, to the fact of raising a family. Then you have your children, that becomes very special in that life and then part of that. Then you have an opportunity to touch other people's lives just because of the way you led your life. And that becomes an awesome responsibility to some extent, but very gratifying that, that somebody that changed their lives like Andy and Mr. Rooney might have changed my life just because of what you had accomplished. And so there really isn't any one, specific thing about that. But with it, with all that comes a certain responsibility, to help people, to help veterans specifically, because all of a sudden, you become, because of the success on a football field, then people recognize you, especially Vietnam veterans, recognized you as someone like us, but you made it. And so I'm living my life through you, unlike the life I had to live because we had to repress our feelings, didn't get any respect and all that other stuff. And so all of a sudden that becomes a responsibility to be able to have somewhat of a voice, possibly, for veteran issues. And that voice has gotten louder and louder and louder by veterans as they've gone through their own personal changes and impact that they can make, and found a voice to be able to help combat veterans and Vietnam veterans specifically in their quest to take care of their health issues that are mounting every day.
Mm. And why did you write the book Fighting Back?
So the book Fighting Back, I'd like to be able to say, well, it was a dream of being able to write the book. And so actually, Terry O'Neill, who was from Western Pennsylvania, from New Kensington, right outside of Pittsburgh here, Notre Dame guy. So after I was there and I was working for Monday Night Football, gives me a call before we are going to the Super Bowl in New Orleans in Super Bowl IX against the Vikings. And he said, hey, I was talking to the guys up in Monday Night Football and Howard and the rest of the guys. And I asked him, I said, I think about writing a book on Blair. What do you think? Oh, it was a great story. Whatever gave him that. And he said, so, why don't you take a tape recorder and just record your thoughts while you're at the Super Bowl as the best possible can. And so we did. And then we came back. And so we started writing the book. We went back just through my life and recorded it. And we recorded it on tape. Then he had his sister transcribe the tapes with a headset like yours. You got to go back to 1974, 75, okay? So we didn't have all those technologies we had today. And so she does this, and then he rewrites the book and so on. And so it was Fighting Back in that story. And so we've come out with a revised edition of it after now all these years later. We've added a couple new chapters to bring it up to date. We've added new pictures and so on, and it became Fighting Back for Veterans. And so the proceeds of the book now in the second edition go to veteran organizations. The specific one is Guardian Angels, medical service dogs, and to help raise money for one of these animals, because of the impact that they have specifically on the health and welfare of our soldiers. And that's a whole another amazing story that takes place. And one thing and one way that we can possibly help rescind that suicide rate that takes place today within the military community, 20 to 22 suicides a day, is that all the research and experience of being able to have a service medical has reduced that suicide rate, I mean, almost to zero, because of that attention. So if we could do that, then that makes a big impact on someone's life. And so you ask the question, how much is a life worth? And so in this case, we can save a life and raise a dog and give it to a soldier, then we're doing a pretty good job.
That's awesome. And what would you want listeners to know about the return? It seems like this is 10 years of discussion with you and ESPN. What was that like, and what would you like them to know about it?
Well, it was let me tell you this. It was an interesting experience. I'm not saying it was necessarily a wonderful experience. It was an interesting experience, not one that I expected to have. So as we were doing this whole thing, as had been mentioned, 10 years in the process of trying to work out schedules and trying to get this whole thing together. And because of producer John Fox, it finally became a reality. And Tom Rinaldi was the interviewer on this return. And now I told him, I said, listen, unlike the majority of Vietnam veterans who came back to this country after serving their time up through 1975, 73, basically, war wasn't over until 75, is that, you know, they were identified with the war. And they repressed their feelings. No one ever asked them their questions, how they felt, you know, what went through, what happened in their lives. They were spat upon, baby killers. They came back, didn't talk about it, went back to school, got married, raised families, got a job, and so on. I said, I come back to a high-profile industry, and I become a story, whether I make it or not. But at that moment in time, I come back, I'm a story. This kid trying to come back, you know, is a 16th round draft choice. Now he thinks he can make it again, whatever it is, but a Vietnam vet. So that story, that became a story. So I got a chance to talk about my feelings. I think it was a catharsis. I got a chance to questions I never even thought about. Now I had to come up with answers. How did I feel? How do you compare it? What took place? So on and so on and so on and so on. So it became that. And then for 50 years, I told the story. And as we shared the story, so I said, now, listen, I didn't have any real traumatic experience, meaning what? Somebody died in my arms, or I had blood splattered all over me because of a bomb that went off, or I didn't necessarily have to kill an enemy. I mean, I didn't have that hand-to-hand combat, and none of those experiences had taken place. Mm-hmm. Did we fight? Yes. Did I get hit? Yes, I did. Did people die? Yes. But I didn't see it and or register. So I don't know what's going to happen when we get back. I mean, I really don't have any internal emotions, I don't believe, you know. So we do, and we go back and we find the exact spot in the rice paddies where we were, we start telling the story again. When Mr. Rinaldi comes up with a very basic question, as we're standing in this field, how do you feel? Or what do you feel? And at that moment in time, I have to tell you, all of a sudden, I had this overwhelming loss or sense of loss that just, I mean, came almost from the soles of my feet up through my body. Oh, and it caught me off guard, and something I hadn't dealt with. All of a sudden, it becomes very emotional, and I break down, and I start to cry. And I gathered myself cried some more and gathered myself, and I couldn't come to an answer of why. What caused that, all this thing? And so we go and we continue the story and we go back to the berm of where we came from. And I'm told, Tom, I said, oh, I'm sorry, I just don't feel very well. He said, well, sit down here just to, you know, we'll get you some water and so on. And I sat down and I pass out. I come to. Now, I have to tell you this. I got five faces that are in shock as I'm coming to, thinking, oh my God, what happened? He died right before us. He just went out. And so ultimately, as I come to try to understand that feeling and where it came from, and we're going back to Da Nang, that's where we're staying, and it's about an hour and a half ride. As we're going to this spot, I was looking at the 50 years of progression, 50 years of change, 50 years of highways, busy people, cars, motorbikes, houses being built, no villages, but townships, you know, and it was like a hustle and bustle, and, you know, and we were going out back to Hepdock, and I looked up to the left, and there was this big mountain over there, and I said, well, what's that mountain? He said, well, that's LZ West, one of the landing zones that we had worked from, and I said to myself, man, we took sweeps all through this area. You know, none of this existed back then. So that was my image going to that rice paddy. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't digest it until maybe the next day and the next day. And we went back to the rice paddy. Mm-hmm. And same spot, same question by Rinaldi. Mm-hmm. Now what do I feel? And I started to cry again. And I finally got the feeling of what had taken place for 50 years was my sense now of complete loss of the reality of what happened. So 58,000 military personnel died in Vietnam. 58,000. For what? In all honesty. For what? For a treaty we had with France coming out of World War II, you know, that they wanted us support because they got their butt kicked in by the Vietnamese. Now they want to come back and reestablish a position. All of a sudden then the weakness of our leadership to escalate this war, president that didn't want to lose a war, and all the information that was coming out of lives that were lost and to their kids and then to those future dreams. And so all of a sudden that was the essence that hit me of why. And so for me then, as I look back on it, it was very emotional, but it was maybe a closure of, you know, of a feeling that I really hadn't come to terms with during this whole period of time. And maybe I needed to go back just to realize that. But maybe out of this, and out of this return, and out of this documentary that ESPN was so kind to shoot and to air, is that maybe it'll help other veterans closure on their own experience that they might not have had an opportunity to do otherwise. And so hopefully, from my perspective, that's something that would be really great if we could accomplish that fact.
That's wonderful. And for listeners in the show notes, I'll have more information about the return and where you can watch that. But that's really incredible. And I think it's beautiful that you're Making that available for other veterans to watch and to process. I know we only have a few minutes left here, but the last question I just wanted to ask is related to listeners who are maybe on active duty right now, maybe they're military spouses, maybe they've served in the military, but they're now a civilian, and they're going through some sort of setback. They're going through some sort of loss. And I'm guessing it's not the extent of having been shot and having a grenade thrown at them. Like, it's not your story, but in their own life, it is a challenge. They feel either hopeless, or they feel like a setback, or they feel like maybe they've lost a shot at a dream. What advice do you have for them?
That's a big question.
Just a small that's one to end on here.
Yeah. No, it's a big question. You know, what advice? I think the advice is awareness. I don't know what my advice would be specifically, but, you know, one of the things that has taken place, and especially within our military today, and the impact that it has, that the majority of people don't really know or understand. You know, as I suppressed, let us just say, for 50 years, maybe an emotion that I didn't ever want, that I knew was there, I should say. But if we talk about our young military today, and I'm not even saying young, over the last 20 years, you know, so if we talk about from 9/11 on and the impact that it has had of an all-volunteer service, a professional service, you know, the deployments that they have had to that war in the Middle East, you know, it's 1, 2, 3, 4 deployments and or more, is that the impact that it has on family and structure, and having 2 feet today in 2 different worlds. When I was in Vietnam, it was much like, you know, Korea or World War II. You were over there. You wrote letters. You didn't have Skype, text, tweets, or posts. You didn't have instant communication to tell me what was happening at home while I'm fighting a war over here, and or living that life of a war over here when I have my spouse trying to take care of all the problems over here. So they're in both camps, and that has been a great dynamics of being able to, how do we deal with this? And I don't know whether that there is an answer to that, you know, but I think that in both sides is the realization of what has taken place, or the rationalization, or trying the understanding of knowing that, okay, what causes, what even internally is going on. I mean, after 50 years, if I have this emotional reaction, you know, maybe that gave me the first maybe real sense of what post-traumatic stress happens to have with our reoccurring military today, and or first responders as well. Let's put that into a context, is that we don't understand what they go through. We're thankful that they're there, and we criticize them sometimes because of their action, but in a day-to-day, life-to-life stress situation, it doesn't happen all the time. And it's like being in war. You're not fighting all the time. You know, the majority of the time, you're just kind of sitting around and waiting. It's boring, and you're out here, but when it is hot, and it's dangerous, and so on. It's the same thing happens there. So the best that you could do, you know, really, what's the best I could do? Kind of have a belief in yourself and a belief in your relationships. Have a basis in which you could have a strong faith belief, wherever that may come from, to help you stabilize who you are and what you want to become. And then it's just a matter of trying to figure out what's going to happen and what you want to get accomplished within your lives and with your lives together. And so there's no great advice and no magic to it. You know, it's a lot of times it's just the fact that there is hope out there, there is help. You know, a lot of it stems from who you are and the structure and where you come from, to be able to handle that you're not going to make the right choices all the time, but hopefully you make enough right choices that you can live your life the way you want to live it.
Well, Rocky, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today in the Beyond the Uniform audience. And thank you for all the work that you do to support the veteran community. It means a lot.
Well, it's my pleasure, really is. And thank you. And I want to take this opportunity to thank all our military who have an opportunity to listen to this podcast for their service and to those spouses that support them. And understand that the trials and tribulations that we all go through, but thank you for making that commitment.
Surface.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. And every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free-flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all-volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team. She writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org. There is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly. And the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.